You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where when you love your team, you force your way through a slog of a game. I'm your host, Justin Mlozeski, and I just got finished watching the Patriots lose 18-12 to the Broncos. And there's losing, and there is whatever that was. It was painful to watch. Honestly, they went over after the game to the extra coverage. They're like, oh, your game finished early, so we're going to give you extra coverage. They went to the extra coverage of the nail biter between Tennessee and Houston, where Tennessee beat Houston in overtime. And the last 2 minutes of that game were more exciting to watch than the entire Patriots game. I mean, the Broncos won, and their quarterback was 10 for 24 for 184 yards and two touchdowns. And the announcers were trying to spin that into he played well and he had a good game. That's how bad that game was. Now, we have had all sorts of, you know, shutdowns because of Corona. We really haven't had any practice, but Cam Newton just didn't look good to me. So we'll see what happens going forward. And for all those people who are waiting for the past 20 years, well, the post-Brady era is here. We'll see if we find the answer to the quarterback position sooner or later. Just like we'll find out whether we have the answer to who the new president is of the United States sooner or later. And that's what a lot of the news stories are about this week. But before we get there, we have to bring in my co-host. Joining me this trip from Dale's Juan, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, Justin, it's been an exciting week here. It's starting to get to be fall. You know, the fog's rolling in the evening here.
You're in Los Angeles, not London.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy. Another thing kind of rolled in via Twitter and discussed on our Discord. The University of California, I'm guessing the entire system, has released a chart that will finally help us decide who is white. Justin, did you get a chance to take a look at this chart?
You pointed it out to me, and I thought it was finally going to answer my question, you know, about what is the definition of white people. But all it did was double down on what I have a problem with. Right. It says across the top, it has the different categories, right? African-American/black, Hispanic/Latino, American Indian / Alaskan Native, Asian, white. And then under white, it has two categories, Southwest Asian and North African, and then white/Caucasian.
So basically, it's a grid pattern, too. So we know from the bottom right to the top left, which ones we're allowed to discriminate against. So the further to the bottom, the right you are, the more discrimination that you are allowed to do. And the ones
right.
The
so first
left.
Of all, the only one that's in the bottom row is white/Caucasian, by the way. I don't know if you picked that up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it says white/Caucasian. This is what we have. European/European descent, other white/Caucasian, white/Middle Eastern, and white/North African. But William, isn't this what I'm always saying? Why are we lumping all European people together? But then you go to the Asian category, you have Cambodian, Chinese, Filipino, Hmong, Indonesian, Japanese, Korean, Laotian, Malaysian. Why do all these different countries have different ethnicities, whereas all European people are exactly the fucking same? As if someone from Spain is the same as someone from Belarus. Completely different ends of the continent. And also, a minor nitpick on the Asian category, why is Filipino under Asian and not under Pacific Islander? Aren't the Philippines a chain of islands in the Pacific Ocean?
I don't know. But to make this even, just to give you what this chart means, we'll be linking to it, of course, because it's hilarious. In the white category, we have apparently south West Asian and North African people are all white. So you go through Afghan, Armenian, you know, Jordanian, Kurdish, you know,
Egyptian.
Obviously we should, yeah, obviously Kurdish and Israeli and Iraqi, they're all the same, right? And Egyptian, those are all the same. And then they list Caucasian, which I guess they actually mean people from the Caucasus in this case. Syrian, Yemeni, other North African. So apparently you are not African if you're not black, I guess, right? Like, I'm trying to decode this, right? So if you're from
I think they would say you're African, but based upon your skin color, you can be white if you're from these countries. Is that what I think they're saying? So you can be white if you're Egyptian, as long as your skin color is that way.
Well, the reason this chart is so interesting, I think there's two reasons, Justin. The first one you've already brought
up. Well, the first is the Chinese, the Asian thing, right? White, Chinese, yeah. Japanese, Korean, they're all different, but Latin Americans all the same. African Americans all the same. Africans all the same, right?
Yeah.
They don't even have South American on here. They have Latin American, and then they have other Hispanic, Latin American, or of Spanish origin. Yeah. Are you? Why is Asia special, and they all get to be differentiated into the sub-Asian groups, but every other fucking continent or geographic region, you're just the same?
Well, how else are they going to suppress the Asian attendance at University of California system, right? They need to tease out the differences here because they want to make sure.
They want to make sure they discriminate
against the right ones.
Ah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's that.
What were you going to say?
That was my second interesting thing. It's like, why are these broken out and in this way? Like, what makes it? You know, why do we clump all these people into white and Asian as a category? You know, what's the use of it? Right, like the category. The reason you categorize is because it's useful in some way. And I mean, given all the news about suppressing, you know, we can't let, we got to make room for underprivileged African-American descent people by pushing out all the highly qualified Asian descent folks. This is why. This is why you need these categories, right?
So this is basically, you know, biracial diversity. This is how they figured out. This is their chart for figuring out what actual diversity is.
Yeah, this is their chart to shatter the fact that we're all humans and we should be treated as individuals. This is the chart. This is the decoder ring that the University of California uses to point out the not the universals that are the same for all individuals and how we can all work together, but how each one of these is irreconcilably different. Because guess what? If you're white on this white category, you have white privilege, right? So I want to hear more about the Kurdish implementation, you know, how that manifests for the Kurdish people, how white privilege manifests for them. I'd love to see how it manifests for Pakistani or even Turkish, right? I'd love to hear about their white privilege.
Well, you won't hear about that here. Because I love the term decoder ring, because we're actually the inverse decoder ring. We are the decoder ring for all of this nonsense to get you back to individualism. So why don't we do that in the news without Daniel T. Richards?
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
As always, if you would like to support us, you can do so through Patreon or do so through Locals. Patreon is per episode. Locals is per month. You can find those at themidside.com/Patreon or themidside.com/Locals. Our first headline is the October surprise, maybe? It's an election scandal that broke. And man, I find this really interesting, William. So I can't wait to hear what you have to say about all this. The headline is, Adam Schiff claims Hunter Biden email stories come from the Kremlin. Not Adam Schefter, not the guy who breaks the news for the NFL, but Adam Schiff, the guy who apparently breaks the news for the government. I'm going to read a little bit from this Fox News article. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, not Adam Schefter, Adam Schiff, on Friday described revelations from a slew of emails and a laptop allegedly belonging to Hunter Biden as being part of a smear coming, quote, from the Kremlin. Amid claims, the revelations are part of a Russian disinformation campaign. We know that this whole smear on Joe Biden comes from the Kremlin, Schiff said on CNN. That's been clear for well over a year now, that they've been pushing this false narrative about this vice president and his son. These emails
Hold on. A year? We've known Joe Biden's corrupt for way more than a year. We've known that since before he was vice president. That came up during his selection of when he was selected to be vice president. People were like, oh, this guy's pretty corrupt. And I'm sure it was before that. Joe Biden wasn't even on my radar before that.
Yeah, but saying they're corrupt is like saying water's wet. Like, they're politicians, right?
Well,
like,
specifically in relation with his son.
Ah, right. Okay, now you're getting somewhere. Because that's where I want to go with all of this. So, I'll read a couple more. So, these emails reveal that Hunter Biden purportedly introduced his father to a top executive at Ukrainian energy company Burisma Holdings in 2015.
Burisma.
I should know how to pronounce Ukrainian things, being Eastern European descent. We are all the same,
yeah,
right?
You're all white, so.
We're all white, so I should know how to pronounce that. It's in my epigenetics. While another appears to reportedly outline a payout for Biden as part of a deal with a Chinese energy firm. While Fox News has not independently verified the post reporting, Fox has spoken to one of the people who was copied on the email about the Chinese energy firm, who confirmed its authenticity. William, is this a legitimate October surprise? Or is it really Russian interference? Because here's my thing about the whole thing. I don't know the veracity of all of it, but I have a really hard time, and I think a lot of voters will, that anything that gets raised against the Democrats these days, they just cry Russia. They just say, oh, it's Russian election interference. That seems very convenient to me. And there was that whole thread on Twitter that I don't know if you saw, the guy who threw out a bunch of jargon to make it seem like it was impossible that the laptop actually came from Hunter Biden. What are your thoughts?
Oh, man, I didn't see that jargon, but I should dig through it as a computer security guy. Here's the thing, Justin, and it may surprise you to hear me say this. False dichotomy, bro. It could be, at the same time, Russian interference, and the things could be true. So separating this out is what's important. And what I mean by that is Joe Biden using, you know, or has in the past used his influence to get his son a job? Absolutely. I mean, the evidence has been pretty clear for a while. It's just no one seems to care, right? This is what politicians do. This is why we advocate for this complete separation of economics and state here on the Midside. The way this is being trickled out, yeah, that's completely political, right? And that is what elections are, right? This kind of controlling the narrative is what you do in an election. And I have a lot of questions about the veracity of this, and if it was given to the FBI, what's the timeline on this stuff? How does the how does it all line up? Like, that stuff I'm all interested in, but it's going to take a while for that stuff to come out, you know, whether it's forensically sound and all these other issues. But to me the more interesting thing is that this is getting traction, and the facts, the actual emails themselves, much like the WikiLeaks stuff, right? Like, I can rail against the Snowden, for example, and talk about how much he's a traitor and he's a Russian influence and how out of context those things are. And also at the same time, say these things are facts. Some of these things are facts, right? And the Biden campaign is choosing not to engage with this, right? Just calling it a Russian troll, campaign, and not engaging with the actual facts, which is interesting, right? Because they've come out, and the way this is being trickled out, I think, is also interesting. I think we're going to see more to this story. It's going to trickle out over the next coming weeks. This is the same thing somebody like Project Veritas does, or even the WikiLeaks guys do. They will, when politicians get caught like this, they'll trick out a little information and let the politician come up with their just-so story that fits the new facts, and then trickle out more information that contradicts those facts they just made up, that story they just made up. And then more, letting the politician dig themselves into a hole. So maybe, pretending for a second that Biden's all there, maybe he's just waiting to see what those other facts are so he can make up the story that'll fit these facts. to try and weasel out of it. I don't know. But, do you have any doubt that Hunter Biden was signed for $50,000 a month because of his connection with his father?
No, I mean, that all seems... I don't want to say reasonable or logical because it doesn't mean what I mean it to mean. But what I mean is, based on the premises I know of reality about all the corruption within government and with working with foreign entities, that makes sense to me. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, yeah, that's believable to me. And this is all believable to me. Before I go on a little mini spiel here, I dropped the Twitter thread that I was referring to in the group text, check that out and interrupt me when you have something to say about it. But I agree with everything you said. I do think I set up a false dichotomy on purpose, so I wasn't, surprised when you blew it up. But the thing is, I'm not as benevolent towards the Biden campaign as you are about the whole idea of, oh, they're just lying in wait. I really think, and this is what I've been seeing about the left in general, and about the way the Biden campaign is being run, I really think that they've doubled down on this Russian interference thing so much over the past 4 years that they think if they just say, oh, it's Russian interference, that people will just excuse this. But I think that's really underplaying what this does. Trump's whole thing last time was drain the swamp. He concretized that as a storyteller in Hillary's emails. Well, he's doing it again with Biden's son. That's the whole point. This is all a rhetorical technique to get people to remember how corrupt the left is. Now, I'm just analyzing Trump's rhetoric and what they're doing. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying he's not corrupt. I'm not saying anything of that nature. I'm just saying that that's the entire point of doing this. And I don't see how this story and the less response to it doesn't benefit Trump, because everyone who's in the middle or against them, it's just going to be like, oh, well, of course they're gonna blame the Russians. It just seems like everything the left is doing plays to its base, and they just tend to believe that they've made Trump look so bad over the past 4 years that everyone is their base. There just seems to be this idea that, oh, well, Trump's going to lose. Oh, the polls are so bad that Trump's going to lose. Biden's going to win. I feel like we've time warped back to 2016, and this is the exact same thing. And this whole story, this outright denial of all of it, just seems to be an echo of that. And that's why I'm curious as to what you have to say about that thread, because that just seems to be another attempt to say this is all completely fabricated. And I don't know. Like you said, it doesn't seem fabricated on every level.
Yeah, I'm trying to read this thread, and
it's and just the guy is, right?
It's a guy who doesn't know data forensics at all. He's a computer guy, but he doesn't know data forensics. So finally, I'm like 3/4 of the way through this massive thread, and he finally puts a correction that basically blows up his premise, because he was talking about how no one would be able to repair this because the storage is on board, which is not true for this particular MacBook Pro model. And he finally corrects it later on down here.
Well, and his whole basic argument was that it couldn't have actually been Hunter Biden's laptop because the dates of everything are after when they're saying the laptop was in use, therefore the whole laptop's faked. That's his basic argument, right?
No, he's saying that the hard drive used to copy the data, so the hard drive that is storing the data, he's saying was purchased after 6 months after the computer was dropped off. But that kind of timeline doesn't bother me. Let's say you're a computer repair company. Someone leaves it past the 90 days or whatever. It's now your property. You can do whatever you want with it, right? And so if the guy, normally you would just wipe it, right, and put it back into stock, use it for parts, whatever. But if the guy like copied the image and then 6 months later figured out it was something important like this and then made another, in my head, you would make another copy of it, right? You wouldn't keep one copy of something like this, right? Like if you think this is exposing the corruption of a politician, are you not going to go to Best Buy and buy a new hard drive and clone to that as well? And, you know, maybe store it in an undisclosed location.
Well, right? Not Best Buy, but point taken.
Yeah. That fact is a weird thing to fixate on. And like he's talking about how that drive costs $90 and that you wouldn't do that for a $75 repair. But again, that makes no sense either. A computer repair shop is going to have a ton of drives, right? Like to clone to. But like I said, if you're going to make something, if you have something like this, if you're in this kind of situation, you know, you're going to get an external hard drive specifically for this, right?
Right. So $90 for this kind of information is reasonable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That's the thing. It just seems to me that they come up with any excuse, and you see it on both sides, right? Any excuse to rationalize anything away. That's what I'm seeing from the left. So next story.
Yeah, let's do it.
Also related to the election, thousands of Amazon workers demand time off to vote. And I put the emphasis on thousands because there's two funny things to me about this story. So while Amazon is the second largest employer in the country with 1,372,000 U.S. workers, including Whole Foods employees, it does not offer paid time off to participate in federal elections. More than 1,500 Amazon tech workers added their support to the petition 1 hour after it was launched internally Tuesday morning. By noon Pacific time, the petition had reached 3,243 supporters. So I don't even know if I really want to read the rest of this. So there's almost 500,000 and only 3,000 signed this petition, and this is a news story. The petition says, "We are less than 1 month away from the 2020 U.S. election. I strongly urge the company to provide the entire U.S. employee workforce with a paid day/shift off that can be used any time between now
day?
And election day and November 3rd.
Day?
Yeah, that was the second thing I found funny. Day.
Well, hold
so
on.
Not
hold
only
on.
Is it only 3,000 people, but it's not just like, hey, tell your boss you're going to the polls and then come back after you voted. They want the entire day off.
Okay, I have to do this because I'm a California employer. California Elections Code Section 14001 requires me to post a notice to employees advising them of provisions for taking paid leave for the purposes of voting in a statewide election. And there's rules about it, but the basic idea is you get 2 hours of paid leave and then any amount of unpaid leave in order to execute voting, that on voting on election day. So that's already true in California. I know there are other states who have similar provisions. I think Maryland was one of them. So I remember being
able to take. So you could go and vote and then get a burger, but if it takes more than 2 hours, you're just not getting paid.
You're just not getting paid. Yep. But only a maximum of 2 hours is paid, as much time as they need in order to vote. Employers may require employees to give advance notice that they will need additional time off for voting. Employers may require time off to be taken only at the beginning or end of the employee shift. So, in other words, like for a restaurant, someone can't come up to me the day of and say, I'm taking 11 to 1 to go vote. That's lunch rush for those of you not in the restaurant industry. So that'd be not a time you would want to have an employee gone.
For the new listeners, what do you run?
I run a sandwich shop in Long Beach, Jersey Mike's.
I saw the Jersey Mike's commercial. Did you see that?
I wasn't watching the Patriots game, so I don't know.
Well, I don't know if I saw it during the Patriots game. It might have been during the Clemson game the day before. But no, it was like a guy who started at Jersey Mike's like as a hourly employee. He had no charisma and no stage presence, but they put him on there. Some white guy. Fucking white guy runs Jersey Mike's.
Which of the 47 white categories was he?
White/Caucasian, I'm assuming, /European.
All right. No, I did not see that commercial. But
so do the Amazon employees have a legitimate gripe?
No, not at all. I don't know why you would want to take an entire day to go vote. Like, are you trying to drive cross country? Are you trying to vote in multiple districts? What is going on? What do you need all day to do this?
So you're saying Amazon probably already provides them a couple hours. They're just trying to stretch it to a whole day?
I think that's what this is. No worker in California for Amazon, they already have 2 hours, right?
But thousands of Amazon workers. Thousands, William.
Thousands, I mean, out of 1.3 million.
The news, it's just crazy to me that they report stuff like this. The Snyder Cut had much more support than that, and it took forever for it to get coverage. But this fits their agenda. It's just crazy to me. Speaking of crazy agendas and fast food restaurants like Jersey Mike's, and this might, you know, hit at home, so we'll see what you have to say about this, William. Why do fast casual restaurants get a pass on appropriation? This is an article on Eater.com. But such is the world of giant, quick service, and fast casual businesses. Find interesting, trendy, flavorful ideas from any culture, dilute them into their most mass marketable forms, and reap monetary gains without acknowledging the sources. Although these chains, due to sheer size and reach, are often representing certain dishes or cuisines to large swaths of people, sometimes for the first or only time, they do very little to contextualize the foods they serve. So far, these companies have experienced little pushback and are under no compulsion to change. But as we reckon with the complicated interaction of social and political structures behind food, we have an opportunity to demand a very different future for fast casual. This is not to say food can't or shouldn't evolve. The very core of food culture is adaptation to new environments, new palates, new people, new ingredients, and these exchanges are not always peaceful or mutually beneficial. Barbacoa has changed over time to include beef as a common protein choice. Spam musubi is now a well-loved Hawaiian staple, and so forth. But ignoring history in search of approachability only serves to entrench distorted power dynamics that persist to this day.
Justin, I have a question.
Yes.
What fast casual exchange of food palette was not peaceful? It says here, the exchanges are not always peaceful or mutually beneficial. Like, was me, a non-New Jersey person, opening a Jersey Mike's, violence against people in Jersey?
And, well, that's what they're saying, right? They're going with their interpretation of words as violence and property as violence, because they're saying the mere act of selling the food when you're appropriating it is committing violence, because it's a power structure that's allowing you to sell that when it's not yours. That's why they're saying it's non-peaceful. It's a redefinition of all these words. And ultimately, yeah, that's my problem with the whole thing. This, to me, goes back to the whole idea where I say that, you know, the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is McDonald's. This is just the Marxist form of what I'm always saying.
I think it's slightly different than Marxist. I know the point you're making here, but it's the social justice in capital S, capital J interpretation, right? Because it's deeper than Marxism. It's because it's not saying the class. It's redefining all these words in with the social justice, capital S, capital J ideology, such that everything is a power struggle, including the voluntary exchange of goods, right?
Yeah, that's Marxist, though.
It takes it a step further than Marxism, right?
Well, because, it certainly does, because it roots it in race and culture, as you're saying, rather than economic class.
Right. And it sees everything through this lens of racial power dynamics and imaginary power struggles, right? So you know, the fact that, like, you know, you try to actually break this down, because the words don't mean anything, or rather they have a specific meaning unconnected to reality, there's no way to hash this without it being completely nonsensical, right? Like, who, if, let's say I go to, let's pick on Djibouti, since they're white, we can pick on them, right? North African country, for those of you who don't know. Or I guess you'd say East African. What if I come back and I have this great idea for a Djiboutian restaurant and I make it? That would be cultural appropriation, right? And apparently that would have been committing violence against them. Except for, according to the California chart, they're white. So what if, like, some, like, I don't know, some Latinx, gay, transgender, war veteran, instead open the restaurant? What's the power struggle there, right? Like, how do we parse this out, right? Like, who's appropriating from who?
Well, what if you go to Djibouti and you stay with one of the white people in Djibouti, and they give you a recipe, and they say you can use it in your restaurant. You're not even opening a Djiboutian restaurant, right? You're just taking that one recipe from that one family, and you're using it.
Well, all things are a cultural construct, so the only reason that exists, you didn't invent it, as Obama would say. So the only reason that exists is because of the oppressed people of Djibouti. So there you go. That's sort of the social justice interpretation, right? Like it's a no-win scenario, right? There's no one can create anything because, first of all, if you created it, you didn't create it, the Obama argument. And then if you took an idea that someone else had and you refined it and you figured out what it is and how to make it mass marketable, then that's not the value, right? The value was the original recipe, not the recipe that could actually scale. I mean, people, let me talk about that for a second.
Because that's the MCU argument. Hold on, you can finish in a second, but let me say that's the MCU argument. That's my entire point. My entire point is that's a different product at that point. You're not capitalizing off of it. You're taking something and you're figuring out how to market it to the most amount of people. Your value then is to get the maximum profits. Your principles can be different. You could say, I want to open a Filipino restaurant that serves, I can't think of the word, pure Filipino food. It's not fast food, right? We're not talking about Jollibee here, right? Even yeah. Jollibee, though, is direct from the Philippines, but just like a home-cooked traditional Filipino restaurant. You can open that, right? But there could still be a fast food restaurant that serves a dish that's inspired by that. Those two things can exist at the same time and not hurt each other.
Yeah, and let's not discount what fast casual restaurants do. The margins in the restaurant industry are pretty thin to begin with. To have a profitable fast casual restaurant, you have to have a great product or have a great process and great market, right? You have to have those three things have to be constantly in balance. And there's different strategies that different restaurants use to hit a balance that's profitable there. And making a menu that could be reproduced across the United States, or even across one state, right? Like think like In-N-Out. You have to have suppliers and have the ingredients and have the quality control on the ingredients, have the recipes down. You have to have training materials so that the quality can stay consistent. All these things go into making a successful fast casual restaurant chain. And here we just like gloss over that, right? The important part was the original recipe, which couldn't even scale, right? Like none of,
well, right. If you're making an example,
you can scale it if you needed to.
Are you ready for a perfect example from the white European category?
Sure.
If I want authentic Naples pizza, I can go to Epcot, where they use ingredients, including water, direct from Naples. But if I want fast, casual, scalable pizza, I can go to Pizza Press. Now, is it as good and authentic as the pizza in Epcot? No. But they're bringing pizza to multiple places. It's across the country. It started in Anaheim, across from Disneyland. Now it's across from Disney World in Orlando, and it's in other states as well. And isn't that exactly what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's an incredible amount of work. That's the work that you're getting, quote unquote, paid for, right? It wasn't the original recipe alone, right? The original recipe that inspires it.
Aren't you talking about the business owner at that point? These business owners, the one who owns the authentic Naples pizzeria and the one who owns Pizza Press, don't they have two different values in their business?
They do. Two different markets. Exactly.
Two different markets that are based upon their two different values. One wants to make authentic Naples pizza. The other wants to bring pizza to as many people as possible to create that supply chain. Right?
Right. Right.
So why is it? This is part of the problem. In America, in modern day America, we have this assumption that everybody wants to make the maximum amount of profits, that that's what the American dream is, that the American dream is materialistic in the economic sense. I don't mean materialistic in the spiritual sense where all that matters is the material. I mean materialistic in the economic sense where everybody only wants as much stuff as possible. When did it become? That's the definition of individualism. That's the definition of Americanism. That's the definition of self-interest, that everyone wants the most amount of profits as possible.
I don't know, because I would always say it's achieving your values, and if profit is part of that,
right?
I mean, great, but yeah, there's a ton of things I could do other than make sandwiches, right? Like, and it's not a lucratively profitable business, right? I mean, I could have gotten into Bitcoin in 2000, right? And be one of those people if I wanted to be lucratively profitable, right?
Right. And that's the thing. And I think that's one of the biggest things about objectivism and about just life that sometimes people miss, that it's about your principles and your values as the primary, and being able to figure out a way to live and maximize the value you get in return from those values. But if the maximum value you can get for those in return is $30,000 a year, well, you're going to be happier living that way than you would not living in your values and making $200,000 a year. Am I wrong?
No, you're completely right.
And people miss that. And that's where we get stories like this. So it's like, yeah, this person who wrote the Eater article, maybe you wouldn't be happy running the Pizza Press. Maybe you'd be happier running the Naples restaurant. But who are you to say that another person isn't happier running the Pizza Press and that they're not providing a value to people? Because that's the point. In the market, isn't there a place for both of those?
Think of all the people who would have never tried a pizza, and now it's not a authentic Naples pizza, right? But in your example you gave, who's never even tried something even close to it, right? Something that tries to reach that to a mass market, right? Like these things are great, and sometimes fast casual things become their own flavor, right? Like McDonald's burgers don't taste like any other burger you make at home, right? There's a reason why McDonald's is recognized worldwide, and it's a huge, you know, a huge staple of fast food. Now, that's fast food, not fast casual, but it's the same point, just taken to 11, right? Of being able to mass produce consistent flavor, right? Consistently meeting customer expectations.
Right, and that's why I use the Marvel comparison. Because Marvel is that turn to 11, and they're consistently meeting expectations. They've created something. Everyone knows what they're getting from it. And, you know, maybe it's not the highest form of art, but you know consistently what you're going to get from them. Speaking of not knowing what you're going to get from somebody, how about the dictionary not following through with what its job is? Or maybe it is nowadays. I don't know. Maybe you embrace this whole subjectivism thing. Merriam-Webster Dictionary updates sexual preference entry after Amy Coney Barrett hearing. So during Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings, she was asked a question in regards to, you know, sexual orientation / preference, and she responded using the word preference, and then all of this happened. So I'm just going to read a little bit from this article to give you the background. Merriam-Webster, the noted reference book and dictionary publisher, added the word offensive to its entry and uses guidance of preference and sexual preference when referring to sexual orientation after the issue came up during Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett. During the hearing Tuesday, Barrett was asked whether she agrees with the late Justice Antonin Scalia's criticism of the same-sex marriage ruling in Obergefell versus Hodges, the landmark case which legalized gay marriage in the United States, and which advocates worry Barrett would not support if confirmed to the nation's highest court. Barrett answered, there's a typo there, "I have never discriminated on the basis of sexual preference and would never discriminate on the basis of sexual preference." That response drew considerable blowback amongst LGBTQ.
Fake news. Fake news. Not any blowback. No one the fuck cared except for some blue check marks.
Well, and then they changed the dictionary, right? So yeah. They changed the meaning in the dictionary, right? And this is my thing about the whole thing. To me, this was clearly a leftist agenda, right, of trying to appeal to the, you know, the LCD, the lowest common denominator, to make her look bad because they have nothing else on this woman. If you're going down to the word preference, you've got nothing down on this woman. And here's the thing, William. This is what I want to ask you about. I want to ask you about the definition of the word preference legally. Because to me, orientation is your inborn, innate view that you can't change, right? So someone's orientation can be whatever, you know, gay, straight, bi, pan, whatever fucking language we want to use nowadays, right? Multi, whatever, omni, whatever fucking words you want to use nowadays. That can be your orientation. But your preference is how you choose to indulge that orientation. Your preference is what actions you prefer to take. And legally, shouldn't we want a judge to use the term preference? Because the judge is looking at actions, not internal thoughts and urges. Isn't that better that she used preference than orientation? Isn't this actually a good thing?
Also, Justin, kind of shitting on your point, it's the actual legal term that's in the law. So you would expect a judge, when asked a question about the law, for her to quote back the law to you. The law
says sexual preference. That doesn't shit on my point. That agrees with my point. The law says preference and not orientation for the reason I outlined, does it not?
I don't know the history of that, but here's the thing. I don't think there's a huge distinction here between preference and orientation in the context of the question she was answered. What this is a standard social justice tactic where you redefine words and have your own definition, unconnected from reality, of words, and make it about power struggle. What about sexual preference is offensive? Like, objectively. Not in their head, but objectively. I have a preference, Justin, when it comes to bananas. They taste disgusting to me. Now, do we want to have an hour-long discussion about whether that is my choice or whether I was born that way? No, it's not relevant. I'm not going to eat a banana. It doesn't taste good to me. That's the it of it, right? That's what sexual preference means in this category is, like,
right,
you said,
that's my
what
point.
Actions are being done, right?
Right, exactly. That's 100% my point.
So it doesn't matter. Like, the only way this is offensive is because in social justice, what you do is you redefine things in terms of power. And since the power, the patriarchy, the boogeyman, the white privilege uses the term sexual preference, and the people who are oppressed did not choose the term, it's automatically offensive. And then you what is it when you go back and you make up the reason after the fact? That's what they're doing here, right? They make up the reason of why it's offensive after the
fact.
They
backwards rationalize.
Backwards rationalize. Exactly. They backward rationalize the fact that it's offensive, right? You can do this as an exercise. If you want to write a parody article, pick any term that is used to describe someone who in social justice language is oppressed, and then you can follow this same cookie-cutter approach to make it offensive. You can do it with any term. Right? I mean, think of how many times we've redefined African American or Latino, Latinx, right? Like, it's constantly changing. Or for trans folks, we've gone through 4 or 5 different iterations about which is offensive and which is not offensive. So much so that even people in the community don't know which one are offensive and not offensive. I don't know what is offensive and not offensive to call myself.
Well, everything's offensive because you don't identify with the gay community.
That's
so
right.
You're part of the power structure. You've internalized self-hatred. You've internalized homophobia.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I always say I'm gay but not queer because I don't think being gay is a political movement. And we've talked about that on previous shows.
Yeah. I agree with all you're saying about all the word games and word definition and everything. I just think there's an extra level of insidiousness here where they're trying to basically bring in determinism to everything and make it so the law has to be agnostic to whatever anyone does because that's their orientation, so they can't choose it because that's just how they're born. And therefore, the law would be, as you said, that's where the power structure comes in. The law would be oppressive to stop anyone from indulging their orientation. So, yeah, they're saying, like you're saying, at this point, the definition or the difference between those two words is meaningless. What matters is orientation because that's the way you are. So there's not really a choice of your actions. Mm-hmm. Whereas I'm saying it's good the law is focusing on actions because when the law starts focusing on the way someone is, that's where things are really dangerous. And that's where your point about social justice, I think, folds in here, is that's what social justice ultimately wants it to be about. It's not about actions. It's not about choices. It's about just who you are and making sure certain groups can get away with things and certain groups can't.
Yeah. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately is kind of the epistemology of the social justice movement. And what I mean by that is, you know, the complete rejection of reason and objectivity is, you know, we talk about social justice as being a religion, but it's very, it's so disconnected from any sort of rational epistemology that there's a reason why they don't debate, right? Like that, why they resort to violence. I think that's the only thing they can do, right? Like they don't believe in reason, right? Like they don't. They see it as part of the oppression, right? And these castles in the sky that they build and with their word salad and constant definition of words and thinking that words and words having objective meaning is violence. This is ultimately just self-destructive, right? It's just always going to produce farce. It's never going to go anywhere. The only thing it can lead to is destruction.
Well, and I think actually we see that in a comment that one of the Midsiders left in the Discord this week, that we see where this rhetoric gets them with people who might otherwise be sympathetic to them in certain ways. So let's talk about that in Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. Does life really suck? Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic is on. Because I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. The comment I would like to discuss was left by Midsider Tom, and I'm not saying that Midsider Tom would be sympathetic to the social justice movement, but I am saying that he's sympathetic to being anti-Trump, just as we are all sympathetic to being anti-Trump. But he is talking about the way the rhetoric is used against Trump has a certain effect on him. What I do want to talk about before that, though, is Discord. If you would like to join in on the conversation and see comments like this before the show, you can do so by joining our Discord channel, going to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast, clicking on any episode link and clicking the join Discord link. We would love to hear from you. We love the conversation. We love the content. Midsider Patrick had a bunch of great content in there this week as well about some of his recent experiences. So join us, talk to us, check it out. So I'm just going to read Midsider Tom's comments here. And then, William, you can go ahead and go first. Does anyone else find it really irksome when someone makes fun of Trump in a dishonest or context-dropping way? I don't like Trump, but I know that's the only way to actually fight against him. I know that the only way to actually fight against him is to be honest and objective about what he says and does. And if there is an opportunity for humor there, then I can sanction it. But if someone makes a joke based on a lie or obfuscation, then the joke basically screams to me, haha, orange man bad, haha, pfft, or things like kafifi. How is the spelling gap that funny to these people? I was set off today because of some petition that Trump supposedly supports. My left-wing friends are all posting about how there are super fake names signing the petition. No shit. It's an online petition. How is this an interesting, funny, or seriously bad event? Now, if you make fun of the ideas expressed in the opinion, then that would be a start. But expressed in the petition, then that would be a start. But I've noticed this pattern of people picking up the most asinine things related to Trump and finding them goddamn hilarious. William?
Yeah, it's so ineffective to use lies or smears or ad hominem to take down someone who is so obviously bad on a ton of things. You know, I have a long list of criticisms for Trump, most of which we've talked about on the show. But when we focus on these sort of irrelevant things, it just numbs people to valid criticism. I mean, that is exactly what the media has done with this Trump derangement syndrome. Everything Trump does is evil, and it's so predictable now that Trump just uses it to get things done. And that's bad. That's dangerous, right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there's a couple of things with what you just said. The first is the whole idea that Trump is such a liar and he's so power hungry that we need to vote him out to make the country peaceful again. As if every politician isn't a liar and power hungry. Now, obviously, there are some, you know, there's a scale and there are some who might not be like that. But we're going to act like the left isn't that way as well. I mean, come on. And the second thing, the greatest encapsulation of this for me, William, is this whole fucking lie that the left has been pushing that it just blows my fucking mind so much. And it was in the mid-side group chat text earlier today, the day of recording this episode. The idea that they keep pushing that Trump killed the economy, as if the lockdowns for COVID-19 aren't what killed the economy. And they keep pushing the lie that Biden's going to bring the economy back and Biden's going to protect us from the virus. These are so anti-reality that it's hard to take them seriously at all. It makes it impossible to take them seriously because what are they going to do? They're going to take the position that if Biden gets elected and the economy sucks, they're going to take the position, well, it's only because of how Trump mismanaged the virus to begin with. So we have to lock you down further. And this is Trump's fault. We have to lock you down further. The economy will tank further, and it's Trump's fault. It's insane to me, and I sympathize with Midsider Tom here because I'm not going to vote, but it pisses me off so much that they think we're so stupid and we would be amused by these basic things that it makes me almost want to vote for Trump to give them a middle finger. Not because I like the guy, but because how pissed are they going to be if they push these basic lies and then on election night they still fucking lose? That's why I laughed in the 2016 election when they lost. Because it's funny to watch them do this shit and then lose their fucking minds over it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I will repeat it 80 million times. The idea that the economy sucks because it's Trump's fault is nonsensical. It is one of the worst political lies I've heard in my entire life. Can you think of a worse one? William,
it's so anti-reality, right? Like we live in a federal system, and the states are the ones who do things like this. And so to like even asking what the federal response should be to me already shows that you're not thinking of it in the right terms, right? The question should be, what are the states and the local governments going to do about this, right? And we've seen what they've done about it, right? And the states that are still locked down, California, are suffering the worst, right?
100%. And I think even you just go into a federal level, I don't even think most people need to think like that. There's a virus that we've been told the entire world is locking down over. So there's an economic depression across the world. So we're going to blame Trump for that?
I mean, we can't blame China, right?
Well, that's the whole other discussion that we won't get into on the show, but I'll say this to end out the show here. We keep hearing that the Russians are helping the Republican Party, right? Are helping the right. What do we say about social justice warriors? What do we say about the left that they always project? Could there be a country helping the left? All right, William. What did we learn this trip?
Man, oh man. Well, I learned that I can no longer order covfefe in Discord, or I might trigger one of our listeners. Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that all fast casual dining is cultural appropriation and a power struggle, power structure. It's oppressive power structure. So I need to keep buying it in order to keep my white privilege. As long as I keep buying that, I ensure that white privilege goes on. So I will continue to go to the pizza press to keep my white privilege alive. As always, I would like to thank all of you for listening to the show. It's wonderful to have you as listeners. And, you know, a lot of you have become friends. I was able to meet a Midsider recently. Midsider Ronnie traveled to Disney with his family, and I was able to sit down and have a nice meal with him at Disney Springs and connect with him on more of a direct level, and that was very nice. So if any of you come to Disney, come to Orlando, hit me up. We can meet in the parks or we can meet in Disney Springs. It's always nice to have you listening. That includes the Liberty.me listeners. Love our libertarians. I'm very sympathetic to libertarians. Daniel told me the libertarians are tracking very well in the polling. So if they do well in the voting, they may get more federal funding next election cycle. That makes me so close to voting for the libertarian candidate whose name escaped. Oh, Joe Jurgensen. Joe Jurgensen, if she only hadn't made that anti-racist tweet that we must be actively anti-racist. I just can't support that kind of social justice rhetoric. But love you, libertarian listeners. If you want to get some merchandise, you can go to themidside.com/store for some t-shirts. You can go to Patreon or Locals. Patreon's per month. Patreon's per episode. Locals is per month. Themidside.com/Patreon. Themidside.com/Locals. And as always, the most important thing you can do to help us is tell a friend. Please, please, please tell a friend. That is how the show is going to grow. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emelzneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
I am still privileged in some way.
So when are we getting the stories about Halloween being cultural appropriation again? It's about that time of year. Will the election overrun those stories?
I'm sure the election will overrun those stories. 100% sure.